Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Vultures eat rotting flesh and then defend themselves with projectile vomiting. That's gross. Icky. But my guest today, gardener and writer Constance Casey, says icky creatures deserve our respect and attention. Okay, they're not lovable, but they're fascinating and often important. This hour, On Point, we'll take a close look with Constance Casey at the unsung, unloved critters that make us go ick. You can join the conversation. Do blood-sucking, carrion-eating, garden-gobbling creatures deserve a closer look? And what's the ickiest creature you've encountered and where? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Constance Casey. She's a former newspaper editor and gardener for the New York City Parks Department. Last summer, she started an ongoing series on revolting creatures for Slate. She's covered ticks, jellyfish, vultures, and slugs. Her next essay is on those lovely hulking beasts of the pond, snapping turtles. Connie Casey, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much.
This is really wonderful stuff. Listen with me right here, Connie, to that turkey vulture that you have so much fun with. It has no vocal cords. It can hiss and grunt when it's threatened. Here's what it sounds like, the vulture under stress. Holy, holy moly, I'm glad I wasn't holding that mic. It even sounds icky, Connie Casey, but you're making the case for the vulture here. What is there to love about the projectile vomiting vulture?
Icky is in the mind of the beholder. And my point is that before we shoot or squash anything, we should find out what it is and where it fits into the great web of life. And the projectile vomiting, the terrible sound, those things all work, and thus they were preserved by evolution. And it's one of the things. Vultures, I have to say, were the creature I got most attached to in the course of writing these pieces, and not only attached to, but in fact grateful for.
You know, you begin to make a convert out of me by the time I've read all the way through your list, and I know it goes on, but I mean, what turned your head in this direction in the first place? I mean, why not, you know, pandas or wild mustangs or mountain lions, baby seals, although, you know, there's a lot of creatures that people love to love.
Yes, kittens, peacocks, butterflies. These things are fascinating to us, but also, and because they're sort of scary, there's a horror movie aspect. However, I also think they've been maligned in many cases and misunderstood, and that some of our actions toward them, for example, having a bounty on wolves or, you know, shooting various things, come out of ignorance.
Hyenas fascinate you, you say. You're attracted to things with ugly faces like eels.
Yes.
I mean, but people dislike a lot of things. People even disliking possums. They look pretty ghostly and scary at night. I mean, what is it that triggers the ick factor?
Well, I have to say, who are we to like or dislike? There's really nothing in nature that is without a purpose. And as soon as you take a little bit of a look, you see that mosquito larvae fit into the life of a pond and are important as prey for various creatures. And I found wonderful people who love each of these bizarre creatures. Mm. The Turkey Vulture Society was one of the most moving groups of people I've ever spoken to. And there are scientists who spend lifetimes studying slugs and are fascinated by them and by their very special qualities, not necessarily of vivacious personality, but their ability to find their way through the world and find mates using their olfactory system, which is an enviable one.
We'll look at all of them. I mean, who are we indeed to judge? And yet we're sort of the species that does like and dislike and judge.
Well, we get to write the books. The slugs do not write the book.
Right. I learned so much in every one of these essays, and I just loved it. I mean, starting with the very name of vulture coming from the Latin velare, to tear, as in
yes,
tear flesh.
Yes, they do. And some religions, of course, find that an extremely useful way of recycling a corpse.
Zoroastrian Parsis in right. India, though you write that the vultures are under pressure, they've had to move to more cremation rather than putting yes. their dead out for the vultures in that realm. So take us in. Give us a little vulture lesson here. What do we need to know that we don't about the turkey
well,
vulture?
Well, one of my favorite things about the Turkey Vulture Society was that it had a list of frequently asked questions, the first of which was, can I have a vulture as a pet, and how do I attract vultures to my backyard?
Well, that sounds pretty easy. Just
which I adored.
Dump something dead out there.
Yes, but that it did involve Tupperware and roadside kill.
Right, bring it home from the road.
But here's one of the reasons that farmers used to shoot vultures is they believed they spread disease. And in fact, the opposite is true, that if a vulture feeds on a dead calf in the field, the likelihood of the spread of disease goes down to zero. If a dog or a coyote fed on the calf, the dog's excrement would be full of whatever illness had killed the calf. Yeah, but vultures' excrement actually is amazingly clean. That was new to me.
I thought that was unbelievable. So what comes out is essentially really and truly cleaned up, except unless it's that projectile vomiting to protect themselves, and they've got a very poisonous stew in their gut that's headed at you if a vulture is upset or feels threatened.
Well, I think what we should understand is the role evolution plays, and that projectile vomiting works.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're not going to be happy if that stuff starts coming up at you, and they can
right.
project
well,
it quite a ways.
Yes, if you're a raccoon who is looking for eggs to eat, or fledglings to eat, the mother or father will discourage you.
They begin eating the carcass where it's most vulnerable. I mean, not to put too fine a point on anus and eyes, and off they go. Yeah. It's no wonder that these stand low. In the literature, but they clean it up, and it's really cleaned up, as you describe it. We've got a caller right on this icky front, Jamel in Somerset, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Jamel.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have to say, I love turkey vultures. I just love, I think they're so graceful and beautiful.
That red wrinkly head?
Well, you can't see that from when they're in the sky, but no. I just think they're really cool. Last summer, I was bringing my children home from a little sports camp, and I saw a turkey vulture in someone's driveway. We pulled over. I mean, it was like a back road. We were fairly close. I do think, remembering, I think we could smell the carrion that it was eating. And it was like two or three turkey vultures were ripping apart a dead possum. And the best part, and the part that made my children cheer, I swear to God, was when the turkey vulture just ripped into it and maggots came flying out everywhere.
Icky on icky.
Oh, my God.
Icky squared.
It was so gross, but the kids really loved it. And we watch for turkey vultures all the time. I don't know why, but we seem to have a lot around where I live.
Wow.
I want to approve of your child-raising methods.
Cheering as the maggots pour out. It doesn't sound like that one would have been hard to smell, but they can smell a dead mouse under leaves 200 feet in the sky, Connie. That's incredible.
Yeah, it's actually worth studying how that happened. Scent is very important to us as a way of warning us against eating bad things. We don't go out and eat carrion. So there are people who study how the vulture came to have this remarkable power.
And it is remarkable. The people who care for injured wild vultures, you say, report that they're gentle, inquisitive, smarter than hawks and eagles. And once they get to know you, you quote one of them, once they get to know you, they don't regurgitate on you. That's a redeeming icky creature characteristic.
Yes. Although I have to say my take on almost all these creatures is that they're wild and we shouldn't either judge them or excessively interfere with them. And we tend to see things in nature as good or bad, and we tend to see things, even on a more shallow level, as attractive or unattractive.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what do they think of us?
Yeah, one wonders. Let's get another report from the field. Beaufort, South Carolina. John, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What have you seen?
A hellbender.
Hellbender. Now, that's not the movie Hellboy. What's a hellbender?
It's about a 2-foot-long newt. Lives in mountain streams in North Carolina.
What does it look like? What does it eat?
It eats fish, but it can, when you're standing in the water fishing and you catch some movement and you look down and there's a 2-foot-long lizard climbing across your foot, it can kind of spook you out.
Where's the last one you saw, John?
Looking Glass Creek in the Pisgah National Forest.
And there it really was, sort of slithering over 2 feet of it, all 2 feet of it, over your foot?
Yep.
And what was your reaction?
Yeah.
Well, the first one was I moved pretty fast away from where it was, and then I actually took a picture of it after I figured out what it was.
And
that
on reflect,
it's very good reaction.
On reflection, is it gross and icky to you, or marvelous?
You know, it's pretty neat to see something like that in the, and you know that they're wild, but can be kind of spooky when you're standing in the water and first see one.
Yeah, might not want to share a bathtub with one. A hellbender. That's a great report, John. Thank you very much. Constance, what do you say?
It's interesting the name that people chose to give to this creature. You know, we talk about bats out of hell and various animals being the devil's companions. But I think he did just the right thing. I mean, he didn't squish it. And it's certainly appropriate to be startled by creatures. I'm trying to get to like snakes, but there's something in the way they move.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about icky creatures, unloved, unsung, generally unappealing co-inhabitants of the planet with Constance Casey. She's a gardener and journalist. She's been writing for Slate about, some of the ickiest, but getting up close with them and finding all that's really fascinating. Connie, here's a maybe not exactly an ick moment, but something like it in the White House, the famous interview with that President Obama did with CNBC's John Harwood last month. The president was dogged by a pesky fly. Here's the president taking it down.
Hey, get out of here.
That's the most persistent fly I've ever seen. Nice.
Now, where were we? That was pretty impressive, wasn't it? I got the sucker.
Okay, Connie Casey, there's literally a presidential smackdown on that fly. Not exactly your live and let live with the icky philosophy at work.
Actually,
there.
The first thing I think about when I hear him say that was pretty impressive was the 3-pointer he nailed when he went to Iraq. Right. I think he was seeing the fly as the basket to be made. And he wasn't going to let anyone else do it. And he's a leader. You know, that's the way it goes.
Right.
But I don't mind people being startled or annoyed or, you know, it's a little different to take down a fly. The difference between swatting a fly and shooting a wolf from the air is great.
Yeah, we can see that difference. Connie Casey is with us from New York. With us as well right now from East Lansing, Michigan, is James Harding, a naturalist and wildlife specialist at Michigan State University. He's the critter guy for Michigan State University's Museum's Wildlife and Natural History Question Line, specializes in amphibians and reptiles, especially turtles. Jim Harding, thanks very much for being with us.
I'm glad to be with you.
What do you say to Connie Casey holding up the ick creatures of the world and saying, wait a minute, let's give them a second thought, that as an amphibian reptile guy, that must sound like music to your ears?
Oh, yes, I say hooray. I deal with calls and emails every day from people who are basically very often overreacting or inappropriately reacting to various creatures around their homes and vacation spots. So I can relate to everything that has been said.
Yes. Have you boiled down what makes certain creatures icky to Homo sapiens, Jim?
Well, I think we do have to admit that many of these creatures, certainly not vultures, but there are, you know, some creatures that we simply dislike because of the way they look or the way we perceive them. But some of them are, you know, truly, at least in part, dangerous to us. you know, things like jellyfish that can sting and ticks that suck blood and cause diseases. So, I think we have to start with the proposition that, you know, there may be a good reason for wanting to avoid these creatures at times. But at the same time, we have to realize that they do have a place. We would not want to find out what would happen, for example, if all of the mosquitoes in the world disappeared. We may wish it when we're being annoyed by them. And, of course, in some places they're serious disease vectors. But on the other hand, they're important animals in the ecosystem.
I've never thought about that. Why is that? Why are mosquitoes important? We swat them without a second thought.
Well, for one thing, they feed. I think Connie already mentioned that they mosquitoes feed lots of different animals. In the herpetological realm, most salamanders breed in temporary ponds, which are favored breeding places for mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm.
And in many areas, the major food of the larvae of the salamanders are mosquito larvae.
It's an example of how if we pull out one brick, it might have been the keystone. And it turns out, to my surprise, that there are mosquitoes whose diet is other mosquitoes.
So thanks for that, but yet it's beyond mosquitoes. Connie, take us into what you've got some of the price to be paid critters on here too. The tick, a lot of people are worried about Lyme's disease these days, Lyme disease. But you look closely at the tick and you come away with a lot that's fascinating about it. We'll get to the bottom line, but what should we know about ticks that we don't?
Well, one of the part of my reason for writing about ticks was not so much that they've been maligned and misunderstood, but the principle of know your enemy.
Hmm.
And much that we've done in spreading out past our suburbs into our exurbs has been very helpful to tick breeding. We've gotten rid of the skunks and foxes and raccoons and various things that ate the mice who carry the spirochete that the tick picks up and then gives to us. And they've multiplied enormously. But they're called deer ticks in the Northeast. And I was completely surprised that the deer is the enabler, the site of the tick orgy, that the deer itself does not carry the thing that causes us to get Lyme disease. The deer is just the gentleman's club where the guys go looking for females who are looking for a very big blood source.
And you literally mean a tick orgy on the deer's back.
Yes. It's and one of the details that I found rather horrific is that they are particularly attracted to the deer's face, because the fur is thin there and the skin is thin and the blood is readily available. And then the female is imbibing and the male delivers his packet of sperm, which he delivers by hand, if a tick can be said to have a hand.
By hand, meaning one of these are arachnids. They have,
They have eight legs, but he uses his proboscis, which is like a little horn that sticks out in front, and it's mm-hmm. what goes into us to take out blood and deliver a spirochete. And he reaches into his own cavity and pulls out a little egg sac or sperm sac and finds her abdominal cavity while she's eating and inserts it.
She feasts, he impregnates, and it's going on all over that deer, and you've got a tick orgy going on.
And then she drops off and explodes.
And dies, and the whole cycle begins again.
Right.
You describe the ticks roaming around on the deer or the human for very often a few hours looking for the right spot to attach. What are they looking for?
I am not totally sure. With the deer, it was where the blood is near the surface. But with us, we're very handy because we don't have thick fur. You know, we're very vulnerable to ticks.
And then the reason it's important to get them off quickly, Jim Harding, because they don't really deliver the spirochete, the potential in infection, for some time after they latch on.
Right. So you do want to remove them as fast as possible. And you know, as was mentioned, they do wander around on us for a while, so we do have that opportunity. So I always advise people who have been out in the woods and fields to simply do a good self-examination, or have a friend, you know, in appropriate circumstances, to do a good examination and remove the ticks before they become embedded. In my experience, the ticks usually are looking for, you know, a crease or somewhere where they can kind of hide and not be in an open area.
Check your navel, Connie Constance writes.
Yeah.
Let's hear from our listeners. Leela in Andover, Massachusetts. Leela, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What have you seen out there?
Well, I had this experience when I was leading a trip of 10-year-olds down in a canoe down the Delaware River a few summers ago. And you basically, you know, canoe and you have coolers and stuff and you just camp along the way. There are all these, like, great little islands and campsites along down the river. And, you know, and I love bugs and animals and creepy crawlies. I love them. They're so interesting. And I always try to get the kids to, you know, just, you know, appreciate them. But at this one point, we stopped at this island and, you know, we're getting our stuff all together. We get off and we're just looking around and trying to pick our spots. And all of a sudden, we realize that the ground is moving. And we're like, oh, my gosh, what is this? And it was completely covered with millipedes. Like, every square inch was covered with a millipede. And although I think millipedes are pretty neat, it was probably the grossest thing I've ever experienced.
Your sleeping bags perhaps did not get rolled out there, Leela.
I'm sorry?
Your sleeping bags perhaps did not get rolled out on that spot.
Yeah, no. I mean, we hightailed it out of there as fast as we could and looked for a different campsite with maybe one or two millipedes and not, you know, an entire colony or whatever it might be the name for millions and millions of millipedes.
Wow, that's a great report. Jim Harding, have you ever seen that, the shore of a river stream?
I have not seen anything quite that intense. I have seen areas where certain millipedes, centipedes, whatnot, seem to be more abundant than others. I can only assume that that island must have offered ideal habitat, which lacked the normal predators of the millipedes. So perhaps that might explain their population explosion. But no, that's quite amazing.
Millipede Woodstock on the shoreline there. Let's get
right.
One from Nashville, Tennessee. Jim. Jim, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Real quickly, first one comment about the lady who called in with the vulture that picked at a bloated animal and it exploded.
Yes.
You know what that's called, don't you?
No, I'm cringing. Let's hear it.
It's called an Icky Pop.
Okay, all right. With apologies right. To Iggy. All right. What do you know, Jim?
My real comment has to do with not so much the creatures themselves as our reaction and response to them, as the person you're interviewing called it the doll in the eye of the beholder. I used to live in South America. I worked as a surveyor down in the Amazon Basin.
Ooh, you must have seen plenty.
Did it for about 2.5 years. And there was just about every shape and form of icky creature you can possibly imagine. 18-inch long centipedes, scorpions that were the size of a lunchbox, tarantulas the size of a bread box, all kinds of poisonous plants, carnivorous plants, and you name it, okay?
Yeah.
Snakes that ate their live young. There were things in the water that would swim up your orifices. Anyway.
Woo! Okay.
Vampire bats, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
This was my environment, and whereas in the beginning I thought it was rather exotic and fun, I got used to it. After I was there about a year, a gentleman who was one of the host national country came down to visit us. He was a suburbanite, had never been in the outback of his own country ever, had never slept in a sleeping bag before, knew nothing of this sort of thing, but had heard all kinds of horror stories. Mm-hmm. And he came prepared with every kind of ointment and protection imaginable, but the funny antidote to this whole thing was at the end of the first night, we lived in a bamboo hut with a thatched roof, and we were all bedded down in our sleeping bags, the candles were still on, and we were talking, and in flies a bat.
Mm.
Well, of course, this happened every night, and nobody paid any attention to it. He absolutely went ballistic, stood up, started jumping around, grabbed a machete, started swinging it. Within about 30 seconds, he had completely destroyed the hut. The walls fell down, the roof came down, and we ended up spending the night under the hut in the rain.
to get the bat, he took down your hut, and you got the rainstorm. Jim, thanks for that story. Connie Casey, there you go. To take out the icky creature, the suburbanite takes down the hut.
I was relieved there was no bloodshed there.
Yes.
But I want to go back to Leela, who was... the yeah. woman who was courageous enough to take 10-year-olds on a canoe trip.
Right.
I think part of the ick factor has to do with creatures swarming.
Mm-hmm.
If she had seen one millipede, it would have been kind of okay.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But seeing so many of them, it's sort of, I don't know if the movie had come out yet, but it would have been like millipedes on a plane, you know, and in the Indiana Jones movies, the worst possible thing was to be in a pit of snakes. So I think that's part of it. And frankly, I will say I would be very frightened by a pit of snakes, and I would rather leave them alone and go off and close a door somewhere.
Yeah.
But still, I'm fascinated by snakes.
So the slither of the snake, the swarm, is something that gets yeah. human beings upset. Jim Harding, in your backyard there in Michigan, what do you find gets people jumping out of their tents and sleeping bags? You know, what do people respond to with the most revulsion, to stay on Connie Casey's theme?
Well, I probably get more calls and emails about snakes than anything else. Although I think I'm detecting a trend. People used to want to know how to kill them, or you know, or want a justification for killing them. I think now people want reassurance that it's a harmless species that they're seeing, and are willing to let it live if it is harmless. But the comment about the hut mm-hmm. was humorous, because people will go to great lengths to eliminate these creatures that they fear or dislike. I typically tell people that if they don't want snakes around the house, they've got to simplify the environment, get rid of wood piles and rocks and things that snakes want to hide under or look for food under. And I have known people that called me back later and said, yep, I cut down all the shrubs, I got rid of all the mulch, I got rid of all the flower beds. They practically paved their yard so they would never see a snake.
By getting rid of the snakes, they thereby permitted an explosion in the mouse population in their area.
Right. Not everybody swings the machete or the DTT. Here's Chris from our website saying, I always take a moment to talk to turkey vultures I meet at nature centers, zoos, sanctuaries. I talk softly to them, telling them what handsome vultures they are. Their habits may be objectionable, but if you look into their eyes, you see an intelligent being in there who appreciates social contact. But Chris says, but then I keep pet rats, and many people find that icky too. So I guess it's personal. It's personal taste here.
As a contrast to that, the curator of birds at the Bronx Zoo told me that the only birds who have stones thrown at them are vultures. And in fact, vultures have been killed by people throwing stones.
If I were sloth, I'd take my own sweet time. If I were a snake, I'd carve the sneakiest lines. If I were a bull, I'd grow the longest horns. Impress the cows and show the boys who's boss.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about icky creatures, unloved, unsung, unappealing co-inhabitants of the planet with gardener journalist Constance Casey. She writes at her own website, theobservantgardener.com. You can find a link at our website and for Slate. James Harding is with us as well from East Lansing, Michigan. He's the critter guy for Michigan State University, specializes in amphibians and reptiles. Getting ready for this hour, we came across a wonderful feature. It's called Green Porno. It's not porno, but it's called that at the Sundance Channel website. It's about the mating habits of animals hosted or enacted by all things by actress Isabella Rossellini, the writer and director for the series. She's got bees and whales and you name it. Here she is portraying a snail.
If I were a snail, I would twist my body to fit inside my shell. My foot would end up at the bottom, allowing me to crawl. My anus would end up on top of my head. Unfortunately.
Isabella Rossellini at the Sundance Channel website. You can find a link to that at our website as well. No end to amazing stuff out there. And let's go to John in Boston. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I am a bat researcher, which has brought me into some caves in south central Texas that are inhabited by over 500,000 bats in some cases. And you might know where you think I'm going, but as you walk in, you look up and you see 500,000 bats, which are in fact quite beautiful and fascinating. But what's really icky is you soon notice that the floor is moving beneath your feet. And looking down, you see that the piles of guano you're standing in are crawling with dermestid beetles, which are flesh-eating beetles that feast on the organic matter in the cave.
I don't know where to begin on the ick. You got the piles of guano and the bats, but then there's beetles in the bat guano, and are they eating dead bats or guano or both?
They're eating pretty much anything that falls near them. If bats fall off the wall, they have only a matter of seconds before they're covered with beetles, and they have to get back up on the walls. And if they don't, then they're soon being feasted on while still alive and most likely won't make it back.
Is that the moment, John, when you say, gosh, I love my job?
It truly is. mostly while looking up at the bat.
Connie, what do you say?
I was about to ask John, I hope he's very sure-footed.
Yes, no kidding.
But again, that's the
reason we always travel in the caves in pairs and have
right.
Neon
Let me help
boots
you up
so we can be pulled out of the guano if there's a trip or a slip.
Wait, what? Right. I mean, because the beetles would come after you as well. Are you just another food source in that?
They do in fact crawl up your legs as soon as you enter the cave, and we quickly shed our cave clothes once we're out. And if there's water in the nearby rivers, we jump in and rinse off.
I'm sure you do. Otherwise, you can never go home again. To you and all those who do bat research, we salute you, John. Thanks. Thanks for getting in there.
One of my great pleasures in doing this series has been talking to the people who focus on the bat or the mosquito or the tick, and they are incredibly interesting people whose lives seem very happy and satisfied. And I used to write about Washington, D.C. when I was a journalist, and sometimes people attempted to deceive me, and it's a great pleasure to talk to people who have a tremendous interest in having you know true things.
About, especially the icky, that these are not slaves to fashion.
Right. Tom, I wanted to ask you, I'm looking for more ideas, and I've gotten strange, interesting ideas, and there's a couple of things I won't do, but I wanted to ask you for suggestions. Or your own personal take on creatures that might repel you.
I mean, I grew up raising a lot of livestock, and of course, there's always some that die off, and you know, on a big acreage, you don't always find them. So I got to know maggots pretty well, not only on dead animals, but on live animals, in the humidity, you know, in the sort of wet and humid part of the summer. To me, maggots were pretty interesting. I remember coming across carcasses, maybe like our caller earlier, where the whole carcass was there, but as you got closer to it, you saw it was all really maggots, just in the shape of the carcass. The maggot's pretty interesting. I don't know if it's gross enough for you, Connie.
It is, but you must have had a sense of horror, too.
Yeah, a sense of horror, but also a sense of kind of majesty, if that's the right word for it. You know, the whole carcass of an animal completely crawling with these creatures, the things that they do and their numbers were pretty amazing. But yeah, sure, revulsion. If the animal's live, you want them out of there, off of there.
Yeah.
If that's good enough for you. Give us a little slug love. You have looked at slugs. What did you find there?
Well, one of the interesting things is that slugs in general do have a helpful role to play as among the decomposers, as are the maggots and are those beetles on the cave floor. And our own native banana slug, which is the sort of superstar of slugs, it's yellow, it's kind of pretty, would be perfectly happy to stay in the forest and eat lichen and mushrooms and dead stuff and leaves. And apparently the slugs that are causing people to go nuts in the Pacific Northwest and farmers to bewail the loss of an acre of, you know, soybean seedlings overnight are imported. They are little creatures that have come from Eastern Europe or Southern Europe in potted plants or in any kind of soil, and they tend, like many alien plants, to adjust very well to greenhouses, gardens, human-disturbed environments. So when you see that little gray and brown guy who's eating your lettuce and making holes in everything, you know, he may be Polish. I don't want to demean the Poles, but it's one of the costs of globalization. There's a blind white slug that chews up earthworms only, and this blind white slug has made its way from Spain to Wales, where it's been ID'd by scientists in Wales, to whom I'm sure I'd love to talk. And it's gross. It's really, it's repellent.
Worm-eating slugs. Not everything about them little, like Isabella Rossellini. When it comes to the slug, you're drawn to the reproduction story is interesting here. I mean, in most kinds, a penis half the length of the body, but then all kinds of sex organs, male and female, in individual slugs.
Yes. What I forgot to mention is that the male's reproductive organ is tucked inside most of the time. And then it gets a little more, the story gets more complex because each slug has a choice to be male or female. And when two slugs find each other, and they find each other through their sense of smell, and they even have their sense of smell is so good that they can tell which way the potential beloved is moving.
Moving? I mean actually physically moving along the ground. I thought you were going to say gender preference.
They follow the trail. Gender preference has to be decided upon meeting because each could go either way. I'm not sure exactly how they, you know, cut cards or, you know, throw dice or
what's
or
it going to be
this
time? Boys, girls, a little
right.
bit of everything.
But the distressing part that I got quite a large number of comments from male readers was a word I had not previously known, which was apophellation. You can probably work out the roots of the word a away from and phallus buried there in the middle. If the two have been going at it for a little too long and the guy who's decided to be the male is particularly adhesive, they cannot unentwine.
Oh,
and
dear.
The solution, which you probably may have read if you read my stuff, is that the female of the moment chews off the male member.
Oh, my gosh.
He then continues his life, but it now has become her life. And the next time he meets another slug, there's no cutting of the cards or throwing of the dice. He says, I'm a girl this time.
Oh, boy.
Every time.
The wonders of nature. Jim Harding, on your critter line, do the reproductive questions come in there fast and furious?
You know, the people are more concerned. They're concerned not how they reproduce, but whether they will reproduce in their yards and in their gardens. Mm-hmm. And so, when somebody's calling about an animal they're considering as a pest, somehow they seem to lack the appreciation for the wonderful biological questions that could be asked.
They just may want them to stop.
Right. Well, for one thing, slugs are, I don't know this from personal experience, but slugs are very nutritious. And there are lots of animals that specialize in eating them, including several snake species. And turtles, like box turtles, will, after a rain, go out and I have seen their jaws just smeared with slug slime.
Oh, yum.
After a rain when the turtles are out there just pouncing on every slug they can find.
Connie, so. you say try sauteing them, you write. I'm not sure if that's facetious.
I think my editor may have stuck that thing in. But freeze-dried slugs and snails have been used as fish food.
fish farms in China, feeding them a lot, rich in vitamin B12, like their distant relative, the clam. Bill in Middletown, Connecticut, you're on the air, Bill.
Yes, I opened up a red snapper I bought one day. It was actually cleaned already, but when I looked in the mouth cavity, I looked at what seemed to be a creature of some kind. And I pulled it out, and it was rather interesting looking thing that looks like little gray things that turn into a ball in your compost heap. And it was whitish color, and I got on Google and looked up red snapper and parasite, and it identified it as something, I believe it's called a Cymophila exigua, which is a parasite that eats the snapper's tongue. It bites onto the snapper's tongue, consumes it, and then holds on and acts as a surrogate for the snapper's tongue after that. And it seems to have been, it landed on any number of the yucky sites all over the place. It didn't bother me at all. I found it fascinating, but my girlfriend was duly yucked. For what it counts.
Did you eat the snapper, Bill?
I beg your pardon?
Did you broil up the snapper?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, we grilled it. It was great.
And how about the whatever the heck it was in there? That you threw out, I guess.
Well, no, I put it in a bit of alcohol and called up my colleagues. I work at the university, and I couldn't get anybody interested to come look at it, so it eventually went on its permanent swim. But no, I did hold on to it for a while. It was very interesting.
Great story. Jim Harding, I mean, you know amphibians and all the rest. What about surprises that people get fishing in Michigan or anywhere else along these lines?
Oh, yes. Yeah. You can find an interesting, interesting things in the flesh and intestinal tracts and whatnot of animals. The whole subject of parasitic creatures just is one that instantly gets people upset and revulsed. Some of these, as we know, eating raw fish, you can sometimes be a hazard if you take in some of these parasites. So, which is why you want to either make sure it's parasite free or cook it very well.
Yeah, but bon appetit to Bill there. Let's get a caller from Ridge, New York. George, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
I got a question, and then I got a funny story also. I've got two semi-feral cats, and they like to stay outside, and they bring me gifts all the time.
Yeah.
And yesterday morning, now I'm on Long Island. Now, the only snake I've seen on Long Island is the common garter snake, and yesterday morning, they brought me a little green snake with an orange stripe across the back of its head, and I was wondering if you guys knew what kind of snake that was.
How long, George?
I would think it was probably, if I stretched it out, maybe 10 inches long, 12 inches long.
Jim, any ideas? A little green snake with an orange stripe on Long Island?
Well, on Long Island, you would have probably the ringneck snake. If it was just a single band, orange or yellow, across the back of the head or at the neck region, then it's probably a ringneck snake. They can vary from black to gray to kind of an olivey color.
Does orange mean poison
here
or not?
Guess.
Does orange mean poison, Jim, or not?
No, they're totally harmless to people.
And George, a funny story you said? What have you got?
Yeah, a number of years ago, probably 25 years ago, I worked in construction, and I had to go down a crawl space and hook up the traps in the tub, and the crawl space happened to be about 3 foot square. Now I don't normally kill anything. I'm one of those people who, everything has its purpose. So I jumped down this crawl space, and it's about chest high, and on the joist was a big house spider. Okay, so I got my partner to give me a hammer, and I hit this spider, and it splattered all over me. Now that gives me the creeps, and it was 9:30 in the morning. And I was totally creeped out, and I said, listen, Butch, pick up the tools. We're getting out of here. And that was 9:30 in the morning, that stuff just totally creeped me out.
Quitting time for the day, but it sounds like it's not your normal way to go around with a hammer, George. Thanks for that story. Constance Casey, our time grows very short here, but you're deep in the Ick Woods. We've got snapping turtles coming up at Slate. Do you feel like you're onto a vein you can mine for some time here, Constance?
Well, one of the things I'm very impressed by your collars, even the spider killer. And the snapper guy this is part of a trend in which, thanks to the internet, people are more and more curious about, you know, what is this? And before they shoot something, they do think about it. And E.O. Wilson, the great biologist, is interested in getting every species in the world first ID'd and then on the internet so you can see what things live in your area. And I do feel I could go on for a long time, although my young editor keeps mentioning bed bugs, and I really have a problem.
Well, it's every problem is an opportunity. And in a time when we're reading about another great wave of extinction underway, you know, variety has, in a way, its own reward. Constance Casey, we're grateful to you for bringing it to mind and teaching us. Thank you so much for being with us from Slate, Constance.
You're very welcome.
And James Harding, Critter Guy from Michigan State, thanks for being with us, Jim. Wonderful to have you.
My pleasure.
Listeners, thank you. We've got links at our website and love your critter stories. There will go out with Peter, Paul, and Mary and all God's critters. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Some sing low, some sing higher, some sing out loud on the telephone wire, some just clap their hands, a pause, or anything they got now.